Welcome to Albion Narrations. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Today's narration is part three of Ezra Pound's America, Roosevelt, and the Causes of the Present War, and it was written in 1944. The Morgan Affair, or trial, will be classified as normal finance and could have happened anywhere in the old world. But the new land, because of the new conditions, offered several kinds of opportunity for fraud. In order to display the problem of the American mentality and its development, or perversion, as a component in the historical process, these frauds should be classified. Take, for example, the concession to construct the Northern Pacific Railroad. This concession had a clause in it which conferred on the constructors the right to all the lumber cleared during the construction. The route went through virgin forest, and the trees were destined to be used as cross ties, but the clause did not specify the width of the road to be cut, and the company, with perfect legality, cut for itself a strip of land 2 miles wide. The land and the forests were the property of the nation, but no private citizen felt that he had been swindled. Similar things are the basis of American humour. These things make for pride and tradition. The fight against the forest and the difficulties of the desert. Marksmanship and craftiness were being developed. A man in Connecticut succeeded in manufacturing imitation nutmegs out of plain wood and selling them at a profit. This trick sent the whole country into peals of laughter. The centenary of this trick was commemorated at the St. Louis Exposition. Imitation nutmegs were made and sold at 5 cents each. One day, when these souvenirs were exhausted, the man in charge, a true son of Connecticut, pure-blooded Yankee, did not hesitate one instant to substitute real nutmegs for them, at the same price. The public heard it and roared again. Since the days of the California Gold Rush, there have been men who have specialised in gold bricks. That is, a lead brick covered with a layer of gold, or even solid gold in some parts, so that the seller can bore through it at known points and show it to be solid gold. After the Alaskan Gold Rush, the gold brick made its reappearance. The majority of those who had been duped brought their bricks to my father, who was an assayer at the mint. This was the period of free coining of gold, and anyone had the right to have his own metal coined. So the stories of these dupes have been familiar to me through personal experience since I was 5 years old. I should like to differentiate between two kinds of dishonesty. One, that of financial frauds and bookkeeping, and two, that arising from particular material opportunities, as in the case of the Northern Pacific. The usual frauds of bookkeeping and monopoly have been known since the beginning of history, and it is precisely for this reason that the usurers are opposed to classical studies. Aristotle, in his Politics I, relates how Thales, wishing to show that a philosopher could easily make money, if he had nothing better to do, foreseeing a bumper crop of olives, hired, by paying a small deposit, all the olive presses on the islands of Miletus and Chios. When the abundant harvest arrived, everybody went to see Thales. Aristotle remarks that this is a common business practice, and the exchange frauds are, nearly all of them, variants on this theme. Artificial scarcity of grain and of merchandise, artificial scarcity of money, that is, scarcity of the key to all the other exchanges. The struggle between the producers and the falsifiers of bookkeeping was clearly seen and understood by the fathers of the Republic. Their wisdom was recorded in pungent phrases. The safest place of deposit is in the pants of the people. Every bank of discount is downright iniquity, robbing the public for individuals' gain. An insurance agent once asked a banker why the railroad companies, which are privately owned, must run to him, a banker, in order to sell their bonds. The banker, with ironic sadness, whispered, "Hush." To understand the American historical process, it is necessary to consider the successive waves of immigration. Number one, those who came through a spirit of adventure, or because of religious convictions and the desire for freedom of conscience, and who were willing to face the difficulties of a savage and uncultivated country. Number two, the slaves. Number three, and those who arrived when the machinery was being assembled. Class struggle in the United States is a recent and an almost exotic problem, in the sense that it does not derive from the founders. Let us take a typical American family. Two Wadsworth brothers, or two men of that name, arrived in Massachusetts in 1632. In 1882, their descendants had a family reunion and published the history of their family. In the eight generations, we find all sort and conditions, rich and poor. One, at the age of 16, sold his hair for a shilling, and this was the first money he ever did see. Another fitted out a ship with his own money during the Civil War. On the 205th anniversary, the participants presented equal variety and extremes among them. Members of the stock exchange, salesmen, doctors, a telegraph operator, and two old women for whom a collection was taken up. Under these conditions, class warfare, in the true sense of the word, does not exist, even though the differences in wealth and position is undeniably visible. The fathers of the Republic revolted against the English ruling class, the younger brothers against the firstborn. Popular hatred of the monarchist idea hampered Adams throughout his life, and all because at the age of 17 he had written a letter in which he foresaw the possibility of an American kingdom capable of resisting any European force. Demagogy seized this phrase to insist that Adams had never been anti-monarchist, but preferred the House of Braintree, that is, his own house, to that of the Hanover. His father held the plough. His son, John Q. Adams, awaited the results of a presidential election at the plough. Perhaps a classical pose, but he was capable of holding the plough, and was not doing it for the first time in his life. Let us compare a score of personal cases in order to understand the foundation of American economic history. In the docket of a great-grandfather, Justice of the Peace in New York State, the fines run from $1.30 to about $25, and the tribunal's expenses from 8 cents to $1.30. His daughter, at least once in her life, went to work in a factory, married a man who became a congressman, supervised the kitchen, not as a spectator, but in order to prepare the meals for about 40 lumbermen. At the time of her separation, she had $100,000 in the bank, but the bank failed. My father, the first white man to be born in that part of Wisconsin, was looked after by a male redskin instead of a nurse. He inspected mines in Idaho and got a job in the land office. One week he had kindling wood sawed by a certain man for a dollar. 10 days later he asked the man if he wanted to saw a little more wood. "Saw wood? Saw wood? Say, Homer, do you want to go east and sell a mine?" I got $10,000 in the bank. In 1919 I met in Paris a quiet little man, ambassador at the time, whom my father remembered 35 years before, in the act of reaching for a revolver to help out his partner. American distances are different from the European, and the statistics do not record all the nuances. Religious convictions, anarchic tendencies, love of adventure, and then laziness. The American tragedy, in a certain sense, is the tragedy of laziness. The sense of justice surrendered to the sense of laziness. Justice was limited first to the whites, and then to the bosses. From Europe, a flood of workers poured in. The national type was formed from a similarity of tastes and temperaments, and not on a racial basic. Those who wanted material gain emigrated to America. Those of a milder nature, the more contemplative, the sentimental, those more attached to their soil and home, remained in Europe. The strong, the restless, the malcontents, the misfits went. The younger sons of the English went in the 1600s, but after 1800, emigrants from England diminished. The Puritans were Bible crazy, but they did not bring the Hebrew scriptures only. The culture of Adams and Jefferson is a Latin culture with a mixture of Greek. Otis wrote a Greek grammar which he destroyed, or which was lost for the lack of a competent printer. During the prosperous colonial era, the arts of silversmithing, furniture making, and architecture developed. The houses, although made of wood, were a Greek dream. Numbers of them burned down. From Germany came groups of religious sectarians. They brought with them the art of glassmaking and organized at least once a year a bark festival. Monticello is full of refinement. The polygrapher longed for a complete civilization equal to that of an Italian court, ceremonies omitted of the 14th century. He got into debt. Adams was frugal and used the weatherboards of his attic study as a handy file for his correspondence. For at least a century, New England took as an idea low living and high thinking. Usury spoiled the Republic. Usury has been defined as too high an interest on money. The word finance became fashionable in the bank paper era, and it is to this that Jefferson alludes in the phrase, "No one has a natural right to be moneylender save him who has it to lend." With the financial era, the word usury disappeared from polite conversation. There is no greater imbecility than to leave one's own bank account or one's own sources of information in the hands of an enemy or an irresponsible man. The struggle between the people and the exploiters in America was waged around these forms of imbecility. A handful of people who lived on little and did not run into debit brought to and preserved in America a rather high, severe culture and a civic sense nourished by the traditions of English legal liberty, that is, by a centuries-long conquest in which the traditions of North European tribes and Roman law converge. The Republic was started with a limited suffrage, which was gradually extended from the love of justice and because of the good sense of the common people. The frontier aristocracy was of necessity a physical aristocracy. The others either died or weakened. My grandfather used to wrestle with his lumberjacks, not only for sport, but to maintain his prestige. Lincoln was the last president of this race and of this tradition. For two centuries, the frontier required daring. With the danger gone, came the people who know how to suffer and to endure, or those who merely subside. Up to the time of the Civil War, the public seems to have taken some interest in the congressional debates. The congressional record might nourish a civic sense, and the names of the protagonists are recorded in it. Even today, it is possible to tell some truths in Congress, but the public has been distracted. The economic history of the United States is on one side, the history of enormous wastes of the natural resources, wastes that took place because no immediate need for thrift was apparent, and in many instances did not exist. Land was given to whomsoever wished to settle on it, but no provisions were taken to protect the nation or the people from the dangers of resettling this land. Often resold for a trifle, it went to form large landed estates, which for a long time, and perhaps even today, have not injured anyone. The following phases follow one another. Freehold, the need of craftsmen, slaves, debts. Free craftsmanship in competition with the slave system. In the beginning, personal commerce without indebtedness to finance. In many cases, direct superintendence by the owners. No man could be a director of the Salem Museum who had not sailed around both the Cape of Good Hope and the Horn. The construction of fast clippers was New England's glory a century ago. These clippers have brought the kind of wealth that follows the exchange of goods with the Orient and the entire world. Even if economic, the history of the United States was, up to the year 1860, romantic. From that period dates the cult of business, which continues an Italic tradition, the tradition of the great city republics of Venice and Genoa, the superba and the dominante. Economic affairs need not be wholly sordid. Usury, however, is a cancer, and finance a disease. Paterson, who invented the system of the Bank of England, that is, the system of loaning promissory notes, died poor, outcast by his early associates. California gold was discovered on the land of a man who did not profit by it. On the contrary, his farm was ruined, and he got no protection from law. The American tragedy is a continuous history of waste. Waste of the natural abundance first, then waste of the new abundance offered by the machine, and then by machines, no longer isolated but correlated and centuplicating the creative power of human labour. The improvident Americans killed bison without thought or consideration. Forests were cut down without thought of conservation. This had no immediate effect on the prosperity of the inhabitants because of nature's abundance. The usurers, now called financiers, plotted against abundance. To understand the effect of the American system, it is necessary to refer to the monopoly of Thales and then take up the thread of the so-called Reform or Protestant Schism, seen from the economic angle. The Protestants did not wish to pay ecclesiastical taxes to Rome and to the priests for their rites. The Bible was invented as a substitute priest. The canonical prohibition against usury disappeared. Polite society did not consider usury as Dante did, that is, damned to the same circle of hell as the Sodomites, both acting against the potential abundance of nature. The Catholic economy had proclaimed the doctrine of the just price. Monopoly is a manoeuvre against the just price. One can speculate only on condition of the market oscillation. The employers naturally tried to get their work done for the least possible price. The working men in self-defence asked for the suffrage. The people won the war against the Bank of the United States between 1830 and 1840, but with the new waves of European workhands, the quality of the electorate declined, and demagogy undertook to corrupt it. The press misled or distracted the people from the nature of the economic problem. Towards the end of the 18th century, the Republic was in revolt against the privileges of birth, and the whole democratic movement was in revolt against the monopolies held by the guilds, monopolies of the opportunity of working. This explains the bearing of Adam Smith's phrase, "Men of the same trade never gather together without a conspiracy against the general public." But the monopolies, the sanctions, the restrictions imposed by the guilds were at least monopolies of producers. The various monopolies which culminate in the monopoly of money itself, key to all the other monopolies, were and are monopolies of exploiters. The situation is complicated when the same man has his hand both in the production and in the finance. Henry Ford found himself forced into this situation in order to defend himself against Wall Street. To understand the development of economic ideas in America, it is useful to know European precedents, even if these are little known in Europe itself. The traces of their Leopoldine reforms have been lost, as far as I know, but the analogy remains. It can be said with certainty that the same current towards the liberation from the shackles of the guilds made its appearance in Tuscany and in the American colonies. The return to a controlled economy in Tuscany was wrecked by the Napoleonic Wars, and nothing has been heard of it in Europe for years. As far as I can discover, it had no echo in America. John Quincy Adams, almost alone and smeared as an eccentric, supported a doctrine giving more authority to the state. He wanted to conserve the national lands as property of the nation. The romance of the covered wagon, clipper of the prairies, finds its analogy in the Italian colonization in Africa. All this emigration had some resemblance to what Italy was doing on her fourth shore, but the former was done without the states doing anything save granting the land without foresight. The natural abundance existed, but it was wasted. Today, among the few merits of FDR stands perhaps a vague idea of reforestation. The insidiousness of banking has always followed the same road. Abundance. Any kind of abundance tends to create optimism. This optimism is exaggerated, usually with the help of propaganda. Sales increase, prices of land or of shares rise beyond the possibility of material revenue. The banks that favour exaggerated loans in order to manoeuvre the increase restrict, recall their loans, and presently panic overtakes the people. Towards the end of the First World War, C.H. Douglas insisted on the opportunity of potential abundance and demanded national dividends, that is, a distribution of family or individual allowances so as to permit the public to buy what the public had produced. Naturally, all that was called insane. The London Times and other newspapers in the hands of the financiers opposed this suggestion. The justice of Major Douglas's views was confirmed by the Loeb Report, the report of the National Survey of Potential Product Capacity from the New York City Housing Authority, 1935. No one has been willing to dispute these statistics. Before entering this war, every family of four persons in the United States could have had a $4,000 to $5,000 standard of living. Only the iniquity, the imbecility of the monetary financial system prevented the realization of this material welfare. War was brought about to impede the utilization of this abundance. Without scarcity, monopoly cannot impose unjust prices. American money was not socialized. American money had not been democratic for 80 years, as Lincoln had democratized it temporarily, and as Jackson had democratized it, even succeeding in extirpating the national debt. The American people, as late as 1939, had not yet learned the lesson taught by American history, and much less by world history. It is idiotic to leave the pocketbook of the nation in the hands of private and perhaps foreign, irresponsible individuals. It is idiotic to leave the nation's sources of information in the hands of irresponsible individuals and sometimes in foreign hands. This ruin has its roots in the greed for lucre, a greed which separates itself from all common sense and every sense of proportion, and blindly creates its own undoing. Man has been reduced not even to a digestive tube, but to a money receptacle that gradually is losing its own value. This cycle has lasted three centuries, from the arrival of the pilgrims who sought freedom of worship to the cult of lucre dominating today. This is an economic history. It is the history of a spiritual decadence. Part of this story is technical, part monetary, and part financial. The aim of finance is to gain by others' labour. In the last four decades, the aim of finance, in order that the gains of a small group be greater, has been the retention of all the profits of mechanical inventions and the lowering to a minimum the workers' rewards. And this was done in the open market, through free enterprise. Nowadays, in normal times, the necessity of working as formerly does not exist. Van Buren, a century ago, was interested in reducing the working day to 10 hours. The working day could be limited to 4 hours now, and everybody could have the opportunity of working. But humanity, or I should say the working class, is not lazy. The great mass is not touched by an appeal to laziness. Only the artist for centuries has succeeded in detaching the idea of work from the idea of profit, and not all artists have been capable of this disassociation of concepts. I do not know whether or not I should cull long or brief citations in regards to the financial technique. The former would be a bore, and the latter may be incomprehensible. Van Buren was opposed to imprisoning debtors. The manoeuvres of finance are registered in phrases such as the following. He increased the amount of the discounts. In the month of October 1830, there were 40 million, and in May 1837, 70 million. Mr. Webster said they must be decreased by $30 million in states along the Mississippi. The bank received $341 million and $6 million from the government. The funds, under the President of the Republic, Jackson, amounted to something between 15 and 20,000. Note, the President controlled thousands and not millions. By using the methods of the bank in order to disorientate credit within the country, by creating panic so as to dominate the mind of the public, government members excluded from the real committee of the bank directors. The bank president manipulates the government funds to betray the nation, greasing the press by making nominal loans to non-existing bailsmen. The bank restricted 17 million of the $64 million credit. If Mr. Tansey at the Treasury has not prevented the bank's New York branch from collecting 8,700,000 and had not armed our city with 9 million to defend ourselves, i.e. the nation, in that war on our commerce. Van Buren had the transitory honour of being called the liberator of the Treasury, but his decade has disappeared from American memory. After the assassination of Lincoln, President Johnson did not have the means to maintain fiscal liberty. In 1878, a congressman expressed or explained his position by saying that he wanted to keep at least a part of the non-interest-bearing national debt in circulation as currency. The Free Silver Movement tried to oppose the interests of the silver owners to the gold interests, but did not go to the root. William Jennings Bryan headed this movement, and a few oldsters remember it even now. Once in a while, an idealist plays up to the silver men, or is started on his career by them. A silverite privately will sometimes confess the truth, as in fact Bryan confessed it to Kitson. At the moment, I don't remember if Kitson published the details of the interview, or communicated them in a personal letter to the undersigned. I am under the impression that I have seen these details in print. Bryan, knowing that he was continuing an honest tradition and wanting to keep it alive, fought vigorously, taking advantage of whatever means were available to him. The chronology of American economic events is roughly as follows. 1620 to 1750, beginning and development of colonial prosperity based, finally, upon a system of loans by some of the colonial governments to those who tilled the land. This prosperity stimulated gluttony, and the London monopolists tried to impose their monetary monopoly. 1750 to 1776 to 1788, preparation for the Revolution and the formation of the American system. 1789, Washington president, struggle between Hamilton, conservative agent of finance, and Jefferson's democratization and the fraud of the Assumption. 1801 to 1825, Jefferson and his disciples in the White House, the Louisiana Purchase and the Second War against England. 1829 to 1841, Jackson and Van Buren in the White House, fight between the banks and the people won. 1841 to 1861, gold discovered in California in 1810, debts contracted by the South to New York bankers and elsewhere, Negro slavery, symptoms of the Civil War. From 1861, War of Secession, the triumph of finance. 1869 to 1877, Grant president, scandals, gold against the people. 1890, the silver question, trusts. 1914, industrial development, technocracy, the menace of abundance. 1935, chart of potential product capacity. 1939, war is his only way out. A phrase pronounced by a congressman to signify that Roosevelt had made such a mess of things that war was his only way of escape. In other words, the only way to hide his past and to maintain his political power. from the annual reports of the Secretary of the Treasury, beginning with June 1932 to June 1939, it can be learned that the Treasury of the United States bought $10 billion of gold at $35 per ounce, instead of $21.65 as in former times. The Treasury does not issue any reports regarding the source of this gold, and even if the Secretary of the Treasury himself wanted to find out where the gold came from, all he could find in his files would be the names of the last sellers. This means that the government, or the American people, paid $10 billion for gold that, before the change in price, could have been bought for $6 billion. This amounts to a gift of $4 billion to merchants of gold, among whom are, as has always been the case, many foreign merchants. Only God knows how much gold the people bought during the war from 1939 to the present time. The trick is simple. Whenever the Rothschild and other gents in the gold business have gold to sell, they raise the price. The public is fooled by propagandizing the devaluation of the dollar or other monetary unit according to the country chosen to be victimized. The argument is that the high price of the monetary unit is injurious to the nation's commerce. But when the nation, that is the people of that nation, own the gold, and the financiers own the dollars or other monetary units, the gold standard is restored. This raises the value of the dollar, and the citizens of the rich nations, as well as citizens of other nations, are diddled. The manipulation of silver follows simple lines. It all fits perfectly into what Aristotle calls the common practice of commerce. The silver merchants are less important than the merchants of gold. Other metals are monopolized, but they do not enter into the monetary game. With these keys, you can open the records, or the congressional record, whenever you wish, and you will find attempts to resist these swindles, though they are getting weaker and weaker. Words become pale. Facts repeat themselves. Truth makes an appearance at times, but it is misunderstood and exposed to ridicule. Economists do not see what stands right in front of their own eyes. 9 years ago, a well-known and able Italian sociologist had not looked at the inscriptions on either Italian bank or state bills. These are the economists of the more than 1,000-year-old tradition. People do not look at plain, common objects. A professor from the London School of Economics once sent me 3 satirical postcards. One of these was furnished with a sort of bellows, so that when the card was pressed between the fingers, it squeaked. He had bought these cards with a metal bon issued by the French Chambers of Commerce that had no value outside of France. He sent me these cards, nevertheless, to deny the possibility of having one kind of money valid everywhere, and at the same time, another kind valid only within the country of origin. The diverse groups of monetary rebels and reformers, lacking a knowledge of tradition and possessing only a part of the truth, contradict one another and do not understand their different terminologies. Fernando Ritter is perfectly right in insisting that the farmer who consigns his wheat to the common granary must be guaranteed the price of fertilizers, i.e. necessary for future cultivation. He echoes the statement of Zublay at the time of the formation of the United States. It is necessary to have the public believe that this paper is good for something. That is, exchangeable for agricultural products or other goods. It is necessary that money be a guarantee of future exchange, and this is in line with the commodity dollar fight and for a just price index. Against this just proposition, Wall Street roared, rubber dollar. The usurers naturally oppose any control on the part of the public or of a state that pretends to represent the public's interests. The usurers want the control to remain entirely in their hands. The whole history of the United States oscillates between these two camps. The people rebelled against the London usurers and instituted a government in America. This government fell prey to the resident usurers, who kept in touch with the arch-usurers in the mother country. Belmont used to represent the Rothschilds, etc. Today, the main office is in New York and the branch office is in London. The ubiquity of the victims does not matter, and the head office maintains a high degree of mobility. The usurers act through fraud, falsifications, superstitions, habits, and when these methods do not function, they let loose a war. Everything hinges on monopoly, and the particular monopolies hinge around the great illusionistic monetary monopoly. No vast reading is needed to understand this phase of history. If the reader begins from the beginning, that is, with the politics and economics of Aristotle and the orations of Demosthenes, that against Dionysius, for example. The case of the United States in particular has been exposed in the books here below listed. As a beginning, read the writings of John Adams and of Jefferson. See Bowers, Jefferson and Hamilton for the scandal of the Assumption, Van Buren autobiography, Henry Adams, four volumes on the administration of Jefferson and Madison. Henry Adams is less interested in a specifically economico-monetary study. Novelists and playwrights once in a while give one clearer ideas than professors. One can learn more from Ernest Poole's The Harbour about fast sailing ships and from William Marles' two plays of the social comedy about the attempt of monopolising the gold in 1816, than he is likely to learn from historiographers. I have already touched on the report of the National Survey of Potential Product Capacity from New York City Housing Authority. Irving Fisher was the first man to publish in America Stamp Script, a book that clearly treats the Gisellist economy. The basic book of this school is The Natural Economic Order by Silvio Gisellì. H.A. Fack of Los Angeles, California is its American editor. For years he has been publishing an idealistic monthly, The Way Out. The Alberta, Canada revolt proceeded from the theories of C.H. Douglas mixed with Gisellism. To get acquainted with the technocrat's tendencies, Dexter Kimball's Industrial Economics would be useful. D.R. Dewey's Financial History of the United States could be of help to students already prepared to understand the importance of the facts listed in it. This book lacks perhaps total candour. It has been reprinted in various editions beyond the 12th, and it is a favourite textbook in universities. If my memory serves me right, Dewey does not mention any of the above-mentioned writers, except Henry Adams, who is not dangerous. The students' lack of preparation these days, this modern schizophrenia called demo-liberal, derives from the neglect in the study of the classics and from the erroneous idea that Greek is a dead language and that it is not useful to prepare ourselves for the modern way of life. We begin with Adam Smith instead of beginning with Aristotle, or the student is beclouded with the aesthetics, poetics, and metaphysics. Commercial schools would profit, if not by the complete text, by studying at least some good edition of selected passages of translations. Those who consider this arrangement scandalous and want to be erudite could furnish themselves with the entire text and a special index of passages that have an immediate and direct importance for the affairs of today. This could serve as a true teaching for life. And this second arrangement would not harm any man of goodwill. Thank you very much for listening, and watch out for more Albion narrations in the future.